Captain Buxton Reel 2. Now, you were posted to France in the early summer of 1915, and during the early part of your period there, one of your main duties was the regular patrolling of no man's land. Could you tell me exactly what that involved?
Well, it usually, the purpose of it, particularly later when I commanded a company, which I remember more easily, was that we insisted on having control of no man's land and not the Germans while we were there. And this meant sending over each night little groups of perhaps an officer and 8 or 10 men, sometimes a big patrol of perhaps a whole platoon, sometimes just a small patrol of an NCO with some men to keep the Germans nervous when they went out to improve their barbed wire and so on.
Mm. Can you give me any idea of the kind of things you actually did on those patrols? Perhaps by describing a particular patrol which you may remember.
Well, I remember the day I got into the trenches, the colonel said, "Remember, Buxton, the dead officer is no good to anybody." And then he proceeded to instruct me to go out on a patrol with another officer. And, of course, on that occasion, every blade of grass seemed to be a German. But it was just a... in that occasion, it was just a straightforward patrol, having a look at what was happening, seeing if the Germans were doing anything on their wire. We had bombs to throw if we met them, but my recollection is that went off very quietly, and probably by arrangement of the officer who went with me to shoehorn me in carefully.
Yes,
that was the first one. Others, of course, were of that nature, but sometimes with definite purpose. We might be suspicious that the Germans were digging a place much forward as a hearing place to listen, and we would go and blow it up. Things like that,
yes.
Generally. And you didn't, in those nightly patrols, take a big number out, because you went out for a big thing. Later, when I was in command of a company, we had on one or two occasions what we called raids, which was the whole company. But we always had these platoon patrols going out.
Yes. I've read about this practice of patrolling no man's land. In the history books, they tend to refer to it as a sort of tactical policy of dominating no man's land. And it always rather struck me that the business didn't seem to fulfill any useful military purpose. Indeed, I've always felt one could argue that the losses that were incurred in those patrolling operations were rather a waste of manpower. How would you react to that?
I don't think I would have found that at all, because it did keep the men's esprit de corps up. They knew they were on top. And you can imagine, if you were going out from this place onto ground you didn't know to attack, and not knowing just what the German lines looked like, it would be a much more difficult thing to arrange. But the men knew the ground. They had been over it. And it did seem that in the units that didn't do it, they got awfully dead and dull, and in the vital occasions of an attack, very often did not press home that little extra that won the whole thing, which we found the men were keen to do. So even if there were a few casualties, I think they were lives laid down that made possible the success in the big show.
Yes. Well, what part of the sector were you working in when you first went out to France?
We were up at Ypres.
Yes, I see.
And the British were only allowed to fire 4 shells a day, because there weren't any more, and we had really no bombs. We used to make bombs out of jam tins. Mm. We were entirely short of equipment.
Yes. What were the conditions like in the front-line trenches at Ypres when you first went over there? They must have been a bit of a surprise to you when you first,
yes,
first arrived.
One of the first occasions was the extraordinary fact of being in a trench that was literally 11 yards from the Germans and below them on a hill. How that happened, I don't know. Either there must have been an attack which just didn't get the hill, and they held the line. But that kind of situation was continually present, of the Germans above us, because they had withdrawn and then held the top of the hill. And so we did suffer tremendously from them literally hosing their water from their trenches into ours, which were not pleasant.
Mm. Apart from the military advantage to the Germans, it must have given them a considerable psychological advantage.
Enormous.
I mean, you always felt, yeah, they were looking down on, yeah, you, as it were.
And when they dropped a shell into our trench and we had a gap there, which I and another man filled up all night, there was a very real sense that they were on top of us till we got the sandbags up.
Mm.
And then a very wonderful fellow, Lieutenant Slingsby, the signal officer, was killed laying the line across that gap.
Mm. What were the physical conditions like in these trenches at the time? Could you give me an idea of what it felt like to be stuck in them for several days on end? What were their features?
No, I can't really answer that. I think I was still in the stage of being tremendously interested and thrilled at being on the real thing after training. Our menu was generally, because of our colonel, bouillon biscuits, but my batman discovered a bean field immediately behind our trench. And he crawled out and got some beans, and we had some jolly good beans with our bully. Little things like that, mm, one remembers.
It doesn't sound, from your description of it, that life was too unpleasant even in the front line.
No, I think we were extraordinarily well, which was amazing, until I put my knee wrong. And there was tremendous fellowship between everybody, which kept our spirits up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was cold, of course, and things like that at night.
Yes. Now, we've talked about the front-line trenches. Obviously, you didn't spend all your time in the front-line trenches, but presumably that these were pretty crude sort of,
yeah,
dugouts.
Yeah. They were, in that year, they were really little dugouts at the lower side of the trench. There were hardly any timber. We hadn't got the timber.
When you were out of the front line into the support lines, or the close reserve, yeah, lines, as it were, how did your life differ then? What was the...
Well, our life differed then in that by day, though we were generally alert, we were slacking, and by night we were busy building good reserve trenches in case of the enemy attack, so that you had no night for rest. Your rest was by day.
Yes, I see. You obviously couldn't do this work at day because you would,
no,
have been vulnerable to the,
right,
enemy. But how did you live? Did you live in the reserve area, in the close reserve areas? You didn't live in the trenches, did you?
Yes, you lived in the trenches.
I see.
You see, you were there as a first reserve if they attacked.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a whole brigade out of the trenches behind, who the divisional commander could place wherever the attack needed help.
These were in the sort of reserve areas,
yes,
proper.
Yes.
Yeah.
The close-up reserve areas.
Yes.
And of course, they were further back where there was training and so on going on.
Further back in the further back reserve lines, was life there based more on
yes,
tents or
no,
huts?
No, we were
like
very
that?
Much in billets from my memory, sometimes in tents. sometimes part of each. And the French or the Belgian, according to where we were on the whole very good to us. But of course, the Belgians, far less. There were more traitors amongst the Belgians than we had anywhere else, people who were slipping news through.
Mm-hmm. Fine. Now, out of the front line, you presumably were involved in some kind of training activities with the brigade of which you were a part. What did those training activities involve? What kind of training were you doing when you weren't in the front line?
Well, firstly, we were doing plain marching or drill, because when you stood still in the trenches for 4 or 8 days, you got your muscles got down and your health got down, and one of the things was to get you 100% fit, and that we would do quite severely and quite definitely, drill or marching according to the whether we're in view of the Germans or not, in any way. And then we had a good number of either little platoon or company exercises, practicing what you would do in certain circumstances. We would have signalers having a morning working on their signals, bombers learning how to handle bombing, machine gunners, each doing their own several job, or else the whole company as a company.
Yes, I see. Now, the position in the front line was obviously one of considerable danger. Did you become very anxious under those conditions? Did some people become more anxious than others? What were the kind of human reactions which were common to the danger and the exposedness?
I think one can say there were certain people who did become anxious. It was very interesting to see the difference between the courage of a man when he was a bachelor and when he came back from leave engaged to a girl.
Yes.
It was very striking. I can think of one man who was later killed. It quite changed his almost bravado to a rather negative fulfillment of his duties.
Yes. I remember you told me one of your comrades, Slingsby,
yes,
actually had a premonition of his, yeah, of his death. Tell me about that.
Anthony Slingsby was in charge of some Boy Scouts who won the Yorkshire Trophy, and he asked to join the battalion, complete with his unit of Boy Scouts as the signalling section. And possibly wrongly, always took the dangerous job in case of his boys being hit. And on that occasion, when he came up to lay the line, he got through the gap, 11 yards from the Germans, with his wire, and unfortunately got up just too quick and was hit through the top of the head. Now, when they got him down, we found underneath his hat, by his bed, in battalion headquarters, Mori est decorum dulce per patria. It is a glorious and beautiful thing to die for your country.
He'd written this?
He had obviously written it recently. We couldn't say that he had written it that day. But he had. And he was somewhat deaf, because he had saved a boy's life when he was drowning in icy water, and it had made him deaf. I don't know whether other men, I don't think many had premonitions as clear as possibly that one did.
Yes.
It's very difficult to answer. Yeah. People don't talk about it.
Can we talk a little bit more about the actual conditions in the trenches? This is one thing which particularly interests me, because the kind of picture you get of trench life during the First World War seems to me to be one of extremes. One hears about the water, the mud, the lice, the rats, And I think a lot of old soldiers concentrate on this particular aspect of it. But I wondered if there's another side of it, whether they are talking about the peaks, and down below the peaks there's a different quality of life which maybe isn't written about so much.
Look at it.
Right.
Well, today here is a lovely sunny day.
Sit back.
Just
relax.
Imagine that in a trench. No very special shelling, a few shells whining over and a plane or two. You get yarning with some private soldier or some fellow. You have your meal outside your scruffy little dugout in the sun. I have some very happy memories. I remember once in a place called Gomcourt. We'd had a very tough time, and we came out to this rather quiet place, and we had some frightfully good tins of Nestle's milk, and I remember pouring that over the porridge that the batman had made. And, well, really, we felt heaven had begun. It was so delightful. And I think there were lots of occasions when it was a very happy social party.
Mm-hmm.
I had in the company a platoon officer who was a tremendous wag, and he was always keeping us going with some incredibly stupid remark, which we all enjoyed. These are memories of the happiness of trench life.